Disc 3.
The leaf light flickered on the paper-thin skin of the old men's wrists, the shadows alternating with fading sunlight. They moved in a soft whisper.
All of a sudden, in that boy's face, he gave me a piece of cake, Bleak.
I saw him.
Why? Why did he do it? He kept looking at me as if I were someone new. Was that it? Or what? Why did he do it? And there I was, me, staring out of his face, and I knew I'd lost.
Let's say you didn't win, maybe, but you didn't lose.
What broke me down all of a sudden? I hated that monster, and then suddenly I hated myself. Why?
Because he wasn't your son.
Ridiculous!
Nevertheless, you never got married that I knew.
Never.
Never had children.
Never.
And the children never had children.
Of course not. Impossible.
You cut yourself off from life. The boy has reconnected you. He's the grandson you should have had to keep the juices flowing, life staying alert.
Hard to believe.
You're coming around.
You can't cut all the phone lines and still be on speaking terms with the world. Instead of living inside your son and your son's son, you were really heading for the junkyard.
The boy reminded you of your utter and complete finish.
No more! No more!
Quartermain grabbed the hard rubber wheels of his chair, causing them to stop short.
Face up to it, Bleak said. We're both dumb old fools. A little late for wisdom, but better an ironic recognition than none at all.
Uncurling his friend's fingers from the spiderweb wheels, Bleak pushed the chair around a corner so the light of the dying sun stained their faces a healthy red, and added,
Look, life gives us everything. Then it takes it away. Youth, love, happiness, friends. Darkness gets it all in the end. We didn't have enough sense to know you can will it, life, to others. Your looks, your youth, pass it on, give it away. It's lent to us for only a while. Use it. Let go without crying. It's a very fancy relay race, heading God knows where. Except now, in your last lap of the race, you find no one waiting for you on the track ahead. Nobody for you to hand the stick to. You've run the race for no reason.
You failed the team. Is that what I've done?
Yes. You weren't hurting the boy. Actually, what you were trying to do was make him grow up. You were both wrong for a while. Now you're both winning. Not because you want to, but because you have to.
No, it's only he who's ahead. The idea was to grow them as fruit for the grave. But all I did was give them...
Love, said Bleak.
Quartermain could not say the word. That dreadful, sweet, candy-sickening word. So trite, so true, so irritating, so wonderful, so frightening, and, in the end, so lost to himself.
They won. I did them a favor, my God, a favor. I was blind. I wanted them to race about like we run about and wither and be shocked by their withering and die like I'm dying. But they don't realize. They don't know. They're even happier, if that's possible.
Yes, Bleak pushed the chair. Happier. Because growing old isn't all that bad. None of it is bad if you have one thing. If you have the one thing that makes it all right.
That dreadful word again.
Don't say it!
But I'm thinking it,
said Bleak, trying mightily to keep an unaccustomed smile from creasing his lips.
So you're right, so I'm miserable, and here I sit, crying like a goddamn idiot fool.
The freckled leaf shadows passed over his liver-spotted hands. They fitted for a moment, like a jigsaw, and made his hands look muscled, tanned, and young. He stared at them, as if delivered free of age and corruption. Then the freckling, twinkling motion of passing trees went on.
What do I do now? What do I do? Help me, Bleak.
We can help ourselves.
You were heading for the cliff.
I tried to warn you. You can't hold them back now. If you'd had any sense, you might have encouraged the children to continue their damned revolution, never grow up, to be egocentrics. Then they really would have been unhappy. A fine time to tell me. I'm glad I didn't think of it. The worst thing is never to grow up. I see it all around. I see children in every house. Look there, that's Leonora's house, poor woman. And here's where those two old maids live and their green machine. Children, children without love. And over there, take a look. There's the ravine, the lonely one. There's a life for you. There's a child in a man's body. That's the ticket. You could make lonely ones of them all. Given time and patience, you used the wrong strategy. Don't force people to grow. Baby them. Teach them to nurse their grievances and grow their private poison gardens, little patches of hate and prejudice. If you wanted them unhappy, how much better to say, revolt, I'm with you, charge, ignorance, I'm for you, down with the slob and the swine forever. Don't rub it in. I don't hate them anymore anyway. What a strange afternoon. How odd. There I was in his face. There I was in love with the girl. It was as if time had never passed. I saw Liza again.
It's still possible, of course. You can reverse the process. The child is in us all. It's not hard to keep the child locked there forever. Give it another try.
No, I'm done with it. I'm done with wars. Let them go. If they can earn a better life than I did, let them earn it. I wouldn't be so cruel as to wish them my life now. I was in his face, remember? And I saw her. God, what a beautiful face. Suddenly I felt so young. Now, turn me around and roll me home. I want to think about the next year or so. I'll have to start figuring.
Yes, Ebenezer?
No, not Ebenezer, not Scrooge. I'm not anything. I haven't decided to be anything. You can't be anything that quickly. All I know is I'm not quite the same. I've got to figure what I want to be.
You could give to charity.
You know me better than that.
You've got a brother.
Lives in California.
How long has it been since you've seen him?
Oh, God, 30 years.
He has children, right?
Yes, I think so. 2 girls and a boy, grown now. Got children of their own.
You could write a letter.
What kind?
Invite them for a visit. You've got a big house. And one of those children, God help them, might seem like you. It struck me, if you can't have any private sense of destiny, immortality, you name it, you could get it second hand from your brother's house. Seems to me you'd want to connect up with a thing like that.
Foolish.
No, common sense. You're too old for marriage and children. Too old for everything except experiments. You know how things work. Some children look like their fathers or mothers or grandfathers, and some take after a distant brother. Don't you think you'd get a kick out of something like that?
Too easy.
Think on it anyway. Don't wait. You'll sink back into being nothing but a mean old son of a bitch again.
So that's what I've been. Well, well, I didn't start out intending to be mean, but I got there somehow. Are you mean, Bleak?
No, because I know what I did to myself. I'm only mean in private. I don't blame others for my own mistakes. I'm bad in a different way than you, of course, with a sense of humor developed out of necessity. For a moment, Bleak's eyes seemed to twinkle, but maybe it was only the passing sun.
I'll need a sense of humor from here on out. Bleak, visit me more often.
Quatermain's gnarled fingers grasped Bleak's hand.
Why would I visit you, you sorry old bastard, ever again? Because we're the Grand Army, aren't we? You must help me think.
Blind leading the sick, said Bleak. Here we are.
He paused at the walk leading up to the gray, flake-painted house.
Is that my place? Said Quatermain. My God, it's ugly. Ugly as sin. Needs paint.
You can think about that, too.
My God, what a Christ-awful ugly house. Wheel me in, Blake.
And Bleak wheeled his friend up the walk toward his house. Chapter 32 Douglas stood with Tom and Charlie in the moist-smelling, warm, late-summer green ravine. Mosquitoes danced their delicate dances upon the silence, a dancing, idiot hum tune.
Everyone's gone, said Tom.
Douglas sat on a rock and took off his shoes.
Bang, you're dead, said Tom quietly.
I wish I was, oh, I wish I was dead, said Doug.
Tom said, Is the war over? Shall I take down the flag?
What flag?
Just the flag, that's all.
Yeah, take it down. But I'm not sure if the war is really over yet. But it sure has changed. I've just got to figure out how.
Charlie said,
Yeah, well, you did give cake to the enemy. If that wasn't the strangest thing.
Ta-ta-ta,
hummed Tom. He made furling motions in the warm, empty, silent air. He stood solemnly by the quiet creek in the summer evening with the sun fading.
Ta-ta-ta, ta-ta-ta,
he hummed taps. A tear fell off his cheek.
Oh, for gosh sakes, cried Douglas. Stop!
Douglas and Tom and Charlie climbed out of the ravine and walked through the boxed and packaged town, through the avenues and streets and alleys, among the thousand-celled houses, the bright prisons, down the definite sidewalks and the positive lanes, and the country seemed far away, and it was as if a sea had moved away from the shore of their life in one day. Suddenly there was the town and their lives to be lived in that town in the next 40 years, opening and shutting doors and raising and lowering shades, and the green meadow was distant and alien. Douglas looked over at Tom, getting taller every minute, it seemed. He felt the hunger in his stomach, and he thought of the miraculous foods at home, and he thought of Lisabel blowing out the candles and sitting there with 14 years burnt behind her and not caring, very pretty and solemn and beautiful. He thought of the lonely one. Very lonely indeed, wanting love, and now gone. Douglas stopped at Charlie's house, feeling the season change about them.
Here's where I leave you guys, said Charlie. See you later, at the haunted house with those dumb girls.
Yeah, see you later, Charlie.
So long, Charlie, said Tom.
You know something?
Said Charlie, turning back toward his friends, as if he'd suddenly remembered something important.
I've been thinking. I got an uncle, 25 years old. Came by earlier today in a big Buick with his wife. A really nice, pretty lady. I was thinking all morning. Maybe I'll let them make me 25. 25 strikes me as a nice medium age. If they'll let me ride in a Buick with a pretty lady like that, I'll go along with them. But that's it, mind. No kids. It stops at squalling kids. Just a nice car and a pretty lady with me riding along out toward the lake? Boy, I'll take about 30 years of that. I'm putting in my order for 30 years of being 25. Fill her up and I'm on my way.
It's something to think about,
said Douglas.
I'm going in the house to think about it right now, said Charlie.
So when do we start the war again?
Said Tom. Charlie and Douglas looked at each other.
Heck, I don't know,
said Doug, a little uncomfortably.
Tomorrow? Next week? Next month? I guess. We can't give up the war, said Tom.
Heck, we're not giving it up, said Charlie. Every once in a while we'll do it again, huh, Doug?
Oh, sure, sure. Shift the strategy, identify new objectives, you know, said Charlie. Oh, we'll have wars okay, Tom, don't you worry. Promise?
Cried Tom, tears in his eyes.
Cross our hearts, mother's honor.
Okay, said Tom, lower lip trembling. The wind whistled, was cool. It was an early autumn evening, no longer a late summer one.
Well,
said Charlie, standing there, smiling shyly, looking up from under his eyebrows at Doug.
It sure was a farewell summer, huh?
Sure was. Sure kept us busy. Sure did. Only thing is, said Tom, it didn't come out in the papers. Who won?
Charlie and Douglas stared at the younger boy.
Who won? Don't be silly.
Douglas lapsed into silence, staring up into the sky. Then he fixed them with a stare.
I don't know. Us, them.
Charlie scratched inside his left ear.
Everybody. The first war in history where everybody won. I can't figure it. So long.
He went on up the sidewalk, crossed the front yard, opened the door of his house, waved, and was gone.
There goes Charlie, said Douglas. Boy, am I sad, said Tom.
About what?
I don't know. I keep playing taps inside my head. It's a sad song, that's all.
Don't start bawling now.
No, I'm just gonna be quiet. You know why? I guess I got it figured.
Why?
Ice cream cones don't last.
That's a silly thing to say.
Ice cream cones are always getting done with. Seems I'm no sooner biting the top than I'm eating the tail. Seems I'm no sooner jumping in the lake at the start of vacation than I'm creeping out the far side on the way back to school. Boy, no wonder I feel bad.
It's all how you look at it, said Doug.
My gosh, think of all the things you haven't even started yet. There's a million ice cream cones up ahead, and 10 billion apple pies, and hundreds of summer vacations, billions of things waiting to be bit or swallowed or jumped in.
Just once, though, said Tom.
I'd like one thing. An ice cream cone so big you could just keep eating and there isn't any end and you just go on being happy with it forever. Wow.
There's no such ice cream cone.
Just one thing like that is all I ask, said Tom. One vacation that never has a last day. A one matinee with Buck Jones, boy, just riding along forever, banging and Indians falling like pop bottles. Give me just one thing with no tail end and I'd go crazy. Sometimes I just sit in the movie theater and cry when it says the end for Jack Hoxie or Ken Maynard. And there's nothing so sad as the last piece of popcorn at the bottom of the box.
You better watch out, said Doug. You'll be working yourself into another fit any minute.
Just remember, darn it, there are 10,000 matinees waiting right on up ahead.
Well, here we are home.
Did we do anything today we might get licked for?
Nope.
Then let's go in.
They did, slamming the door as they went. Chapter 33. The house stood on the edge of the ravine. It looked haunted, just like everyone said it was. Tom and Charlie and Beau followed Doug up the side of the ravine and stood in front of the strange house at 9 o'clock at night. In the distance, the courthouse clock bonged off the hour. There it is, said Doug. He turned his head right and left as if he was looking for something.
What are we going to do? Asked Tom.
Well, said Bo, is it haunted, like they said?
From what I've heard, at 8 o'clock, no, said Doug, and not at 9. But starting around 10, strange sounds start to come from the house. I think we should hang around and find out. Besides, Lisa Bell said that she and her friends were going to be here. Let's wait and see.
They stood by some bushes by the front porch steps, and they waited, and at last the moon came up. There was a sound of footsteps along the path somewhere, and from inside the house, the sounds of someone going up some stairs. Doug stood alert, craned his neck, but he couldn't quite see what was going on.
Heck, said Charlie at last. What are we doing here? I'm gosh awful bored. I got homework. I think I better head home.
Hold on, said Doug. Let's wait just a few more minutes.
They waited as the moon got higher. And then, a little after 10, as the last peals of the courthouse clock faded away on the night air, they heard the noises. From inside the house, faint at first, almost imperceptible, there came a sound of rustling and scraping, as if someone was shifting trunks from one room to another. A few minutes later, they heard a sharp cry, and then another cry, and then a sort of whispering and rustling, and finally, a dull thump.
Those, said Doug, were definitely ghost sounds, like someone getting killed and the bodies being dragged around the rooms. Doesn't it sound like that?
Heck, said Tom, I don't know.
Don't ask me, said Bo.
Well, said Charlie, it sure is a god-awful racket. If there's another scream, I'm getting out of here.
They stood alert and waited, almost not breathing. Silence. And then suddenly more groans and cries, and then something that sounded like a weak cry,
help.
Then it faded away.
That's it, said Charlie. I've had enough.
Me too, said Bo.
The two boys turned tail and ran. There was a great whispering, and the hair stood up on the back of Doug's neck.
I don't know about you, said Tom, but I'm getting out of here. If you want to stay to listen to some darn ghosts, you can, but not me. I'll see you at home, Doug.
Tom turned and ran. Alone, Doug stood for a long while staring at the old house. Then he heard someone coming up the path behind him. He turned, his fists clenched, ready to defend himself against the midnight assailant.
Lisa Bell, he said. What are you doing here?
I told you I'd be here. But what are you doing here? I thought you were a scaredy cat. Is it true what they say? Did you find out anything? I mean, it's all darn foolishness, isn't it? There's no such thing as ghosts, is there? That place can't be haunted.
We thought, said Doug, we'd come here and wait and see.
But the others got scared and left. And now it's only me. So I'm just standing here, waiting, listening.
They listened. A low cry wafted out of the house into the night air. Lisa Bell said,
is that a ghost?
Doug strained to listen.
Yes, that's one.
A moment later, they heard another great whisper and cry.
Is that another?
Doug looked at her face and said,
you look like you're enjoying this. I don't know, said Lisa Bell. It's kind of strange, but the more I hear, I...
And here she smiled a strange smile. The whispers and the cries and murmurs from the house grew louder, and Doug felt his whole body turn hot and then cold and then warm again. Finally, he reached down and found a large stone by the front of the house, reared his hand back, and flung it through the glass panes of the front door. The glass exploded with a loud crash, and the door creaked open slowly. Suddenly, all the ghosts wailed at the same moment.
Doug, cried Lisa Bell. Why did you do that?
Because, said Doug.
And then it happened. There was a rush of feet, a torrent of whispers, and a swirling mob of white shapes burst out of the house and down the stairs and along the path and away into the ravine.
"Tug," said Lisa Bell,
"why'd you do that?"
"Because," said Doug, "I couldn't stand it anymore. Someone had to scare them out. Someone had to act like they knew what they were doing. I'll bet they won't come back."
"That's terrible," said Lisa Bell. "Why would you want ghosts not to be here?"
"Why would you think," said Doug, "that they had a right to be here? We don't even know who they were."
"Well," said Lisa Bell angrily, "just for that, I'm going to teach you a lesson."
"What?" said Douglas.
And Lisa Bell stepped up to him, grabbed him by the ears, and planted an immense kiss on Douglas's mouth.
It lasted only an instant, but it was a blow like a bolt of lightning that had come out of the air and struck his face and anguished his body. He shook from head to toe, his fingers extended, and somehow he imagined sparks firing out of his fingertips. His eyelids jittered, and a fantastic flow of sweat broke out on his brow. He gasped and could not breathe.
Lisa Bell stood back, surveying her creation. Douglas Spaulding, hit by lightning.
Douglas fell back, afraid that she might touch him again. She laughed, her face merry.
"So there," she cried. "That'll fix you."
She turned and ran away and left him in the invisible rain, a terrible storm, shaken, his whole body now hot, now cold, his jaw dropped, his lips trembling. The explosion of the lightning bolt hit him again in memory, even stronger than when it had first struck. Slowly, Doug felt himself sink to his knees, his head shaking, his mind wondering at what had happened and where Lisa Bell had gone. He looked up at the now truly empty house. He wondered if he should go up the stairs and find out if maybe he hadn't just come out of the house himself.
"Tom," he whispered, "take me home."
And then he remembered. Tom wasn't there. He turned, stumbled, almost fell down into the ravine, and tried to find his way home.
Chapter 34. Quartermain woke laughing. He lay wondering what in god-awful hell had made him happy. What was the dream, gone now, but so wondrous that it cracked his face and uncorked something resembling a chuckle beneath his ribs? Holy Jesus, what? In the dark, he dialed Bleak.
"Do you know what time it is?" Bleak cried. "There's only one thing you ever wait half the night to churn my guts with, your stupid war. I thought you said the damn thing was over."
"It is, it is."
"It is what?" shouted Bleak.
"Over," said Quartermain. "There are just a few more things I want to make sure of. It's what you would call the joyful aftermath. Bleak, remember the collection of oddities and medical freaks we put together one summer for a town fair all those years ago? Do you think we could find those jars? Are they up in an attic or down in a basement somewhere?"
"I suppose so, but why?"
"Find them. Unlock them. We're bringing them out in the open again. Gather our army of gray. We have work to do. It's time."
Click. Hum. Chapter 35. A huge question mark, painted on a plywood shingle, hung over the tent entryway. The tent had been erected on one side of the lakefront grounds, and the entrance gave way into the darkness of a haphazardly constructed plywood lean-to museum. Inside was a series of platforms on which were no freaks, no beasts, no magicians, no people. Somehow, overnight, this mystery tent had appeared, as if it had pitched itself. Across town, Quartermain smiled. That morning, in school, Doug had found an unsigned, handwritten note in his desk. Its message was simple,
written with black ink in large block letters. The Mystery of Life Explained. At the Lakefront. Limited time only. Doug passed the note among his friends, and as soon as school let out for the day, the boys had rushed down here as fast as their feet could carry them. Now, entering the question mark tent with his friends, Doug was incredibly disappointed. My God, no bones, no dinosaurs, no mad generals at war, he thought. Nothing but night-dark canvas and flat platforms and... Douglas peered. Charlie squinted. Will, Bo, and Tom came last into the smell of old wood and tar paper. There wasn't even a curator with a tall hat and baton to guide them along. There was only... On top of a series of small tables were a number of large 1 and 2 gallon jars, filled to the brim with a thick, clear liquid. Each jar was topped by a glass lid, and each lid had a red number on it, 12 in all, each number painted in a shaky hand. And inside each of the jars, maybe that was it, at last, the things implied by the huge question mark outside.
Heck, muttered Bo. There's nothing here. What a jip. So long, you guys.
And Bo turned, pushed the tent flap aside, and left.
Wait,
said Douglas, but Bo was already gone.
Tom, Charlie, Will, you won't leave, will you? You'll miss out if you go.
But there's nothing here, just some old jars.
Wait, said Doug. It's more than just jars. What's in the jars? Come on, let's look closer.
They edged up to the platform and crept along, staring into the jars, one after another. There were no labels to tell them what they were looking at, just glass and liquid and a soft light that seemed to pulse within the liquid and shone on their eager, sweaty faces.
What is that stuff in there? Asked Tom.
Gosh knows. Look close.
Their eyes moved along, darted and stayed and darted, fastened and examined until their noses dilated and their mouths gaped.
What's that, Doug? And that? And that one there? How do I know? Move!
Doug went back to the beginning of the row and crouched down in front of the first jar, so his eyes were level with whatever was inside it. The big, bright glass jar held what looked like a giant, cold, gray oyster. Doug peered at it, mumbled something to himself, then stood up and moved on. The boys followed. Suspended within the liquid in the next jar was something that looked like a bit of translucent seaweed, or no, more like a seahorse. A miniature seahorse, sure. And the glass jar after that held something that resembled a skinned rabbit. Or a raw cat with its fur shucked, getting bigger. The boy's eyes moved, darted, stayed, flicked back to examine the first, second, third, fourth jars again.
What's in this one, Doug?
5, 6, 7.
Look!
They all looked, and it might have been another animal, a squirrel or a monkey.
Sure, a monkey.
But with transparent skin and a strange, sorrowful expression. 8, 9, 10... 11. The jars were numbered, but had no names. There was nothing to hint at what the boys were looking at, what it was that froze their veins and iced their blood. Until at last, at the far end of the row, near the exit sign, they reached the last jar, and all leaned toward it and blinked.
That can't be!
No. It is, gasped Douglas. A baby!
What's it doing in there?
Being dead, dummy.
Yeah, but how?
All their eyes swiveled to rush back, 11, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, and 4, and 3, and 2, and 1, to the first jar, the one holding the pale little oyster curlicue.
If that's a baby,
then, said Will, all numbness,
what in blazes are all those creepy things in the other jars?
Douglas counted backward, then forward again, but stayed silent, his icy flesh all goosebumps.
I got nothing to say. Upchuck, Doug. Upchuck.
Those things in the jars, Doug began, face pale, voice paler. They're babies, too. It was as if half a dozen sledgehammers had slammed into half a dozen stomachs.
Don't look like babies.
Things from another world, maybe.
Another world, thought Douglas. In those jars, drowned. Another world.
Jellyfish, Charlie said. Squids, you know.
I know, thought Douglas. Undersea.
It's got blue eyes, Will whispered. It's looking at us.
No, it's not, said Doug. It's drowned.
Come on, Doug, Tom whispered. I got the willies.
Willies, heck, Charlie said. I got the heebie-jeebies. Where'd all this stuff come from?
I don't know,
Douglas said, chafing his elbows.
The wax museum last year, that was sort of like this.
These aren't wax, said Tom.
Oh, gosh, Doug, that's a real baby there. Used to be alive. I've never seen a dead baby before. I'm gonna be sick.
Run outside. Go on. Tom turned and ran. In a moment, Charlie backed off and followed, his eyes darting from the baby to the jellyfish or whatever it was, and then to the seahorse or what might be someone's earlobes, tympanum and all.
How come there's no one here to tell us what all this stuff is?
Will wondered. Maybe, said Doug slowly. Maybe they're afraid to tell, or can't tell, or won't.
Lord, said Will. I'm froze.
From outside the tent's canvas walls came the sounds of Tom being sick.
Hey!
Will cried suddenly.
It moved!
Doug reached his hand out to the glass.
No, it didn't.
It moved, darn it. It doesn't like us staring at it. Moved, I'm telling you. That's enough for me. So long, Doug.
And Doug was left alone in the dark tent with the cold glass jars, holding the blind things that stared out with eyes that seemed to say how awful it was to be dead.
There's nobody to ask, thought Douglas. No one here. No one to ask and no one to tell. How do we find out? Will we ever know?
From the far end of the tent museum came the sound of high-pitched laughter. Six girls ran into the tent, giggling, letting in a bright wedge of sunlight. Once the tent flap closed, they stopped laughing, enveloped suddenly in darkness. Doug turned blindly and walked out into the light. He took a deep breath of the hot summer-like air and squeezed his eyes shut. He could still see the platforms and the tables and the glass jars filled with thick fluid, and in the fluid, suspended. Strange bits of tissue, alien forms from far unknown territories. What could be a swamp water creature with half an eye and half a limb, he knew, was not. What could be a fragment of ghost, of a spiritual upchuck come out of a fog-bound book in a night library, was not. What could be the stillborn discharge of a favorite dog, was not. In his mind's eye, the things in the jars seemed to melt from fluid to fluid, light to light. If you flicked your eyes from jar to jar, you could almost snap them to life, as if you were running bits of film over your eyeballs, so that the tiny things became large and then larger, shaping themselves into fingers, hands, palms, wrists, elbows, until, finally, asleep, the last shape opened wide its dull blue lashless eyes and fixed you with its gaze that cried, "Look! See! I'm trapped here forever! What am I? What is the question? What? What? Could it be you there, below, outside, looking in? Could it be that I am you?" Beside him, rooted to the grass, stood Charlie and Will and Tom.
"What was that all about?"
Will whispered.
"I almost..."
Doug started, but Tom interrupted, tears running down his cheeks.
"How come I'm crying?"
"Why would anyone be crying?"
said Will, but his eyes were wet too.
Darn,
he whispered. They heard a creaking sound. From the corner of his eye, Douglas saw a woman go by pushing a carriage in which something struggled and cried. Beyond, in the afternoon crowd, a pretty woman walked arm in arm with a sailor. Down by the lake, a mob of girls played tag, hair flying, leaping, bounding, measuring the sand with swift feet. The girls ran away down the shore, and Douglas, hearing their laughter, turned his gaze back to the tent, the entry, and the large, strange question mark. Douglas started to move back toward the tent, like a sleepwalker.
Doug, said Tom, where you going? You going back in to look at all that junk again?
Maybe.
Why?
Exploded Will.
Creepy-looking stuff that someone stuck in old pickle jars? I'm going home.
Come on. You go on, said Doug.
Besides, said Will, passing a hand across his forehead, I don't feel so good. Maybe I'm scared. How about you?
What's to be scared of? Said Tom. Like you said, it's just some creepy old stuff.
See you later, guys. Doug walked slowly to the entryway and stopped in the shadows. Tom, wait for me. Doug vanished.
Doug!
Tom cried, face pale, shouting into the tent at the tables and jars and alien creatures.
Be careful, Doug! Watch out!
He started to follow, but stopped, shivering, clutching his elbows, gritting his teeth, half in, half out of night, half in, half out of sun. Part 3. Appomattox. Chapter 36. Suddenly the town was full of girls. Girls running here, walking there, going indoors, coming out. Girls in the dime store, girls dangling their legs at the soda fountain. Girls in mirrors or reflected in windows, stepping off curbs or stepping up. And all of them, all in bright, not yet fall, not quite autumn dresses, and all, well, maybe not all, but almost all, with wind blowing their hair, and all with downcast eyes looking to see where their shoes might take them. It seemed to happen overnight, this infestation of girls, and Douglas walked through the town as if it were a mirror maze, walked down to the ravine steps and halfway up the jungle path before he realized where he was. From the top of the last rise, he could almost see the lake and the sand and the tent with the question mark over the entrance. He kept walking and found himself inexplicably in Mr. Quartermain's front yard, waiting for... he couldn't say what. Quartermain, half hidden in shadow on the front porch, leaned forward in his rocking chair, creaking the wicker, creaking his bones. For a long moment, the old man looked one way, the boy another, until their gazes locked.
"Douglas Spaulding?" Quartermain said.
"Mr. Quartermain?" asked the boy. It was as if they were meeting for the first time.
"Douglas Spaulding."
This time it was not a question, but a confirmation.
"Douglas Hingston Spaulding."
"Sir." And this was not a question from the boy either. "Mr. Calvin C. Quartermain." And again, "Sir."
"What are you doing down there, so far out on the lawn?"
Douglas was surprised. "Dunno."
"Why don't you come up here?" said Quartermain.
"I've got to get home," said Douglas.
"No hurry. Why don't we sort out the sick transits, letting loose the dogs of war, havoc's cried, all that?"
Douglas almost laughed, but found he could not take the first step.
"Look," said Quartermain, "if I take out my teeth, I won't bite."
He pantomimed as if removing something from his mouth, but stopped, for Douglas was on the first step, and then the second, and finally at the top, where the old man nodded at another rocker. Whereupon a remarkable thing took place.
even as Douglas sat, it seemed that the porch planks sank the merest half-inch under his weight. Simultaneously, Mr. Quatermain felt his wicker seat move up half an inch. Then, still further, as Quatermain settled back in his rocker, the porch sank under him. And at that precise moment, the chair under Douglas rose silently a quarter inch. So that each, only sensing, only half-knowing, felt that he occupied one end of an invisible teeter-totter, which, as they spoke quietly, moved up, moved down, first Douglas sinking as Quatermain rose, then Quatermain descending as Douglas imperceptibly lifted, now one up, now down, now the other up, now down. Slowly, slowly. Now Quatermain high in the soft air of the dying summer. A moment later, Douglas the same. Sir?
Yes, son.
He's never called me that before, thought Douglas, and looked at the old man's face softened with some half-perceived sympathy. Quatermain leaned forward.
Before you ask me whatever you've got on your mind, let me ask you something.
Sir? The old man's voice was quiet.
How old are you?
Doug felt the breath sift over his lips. 81?
What?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. At last Douglas added, And you, sir?
Well, now, said Quatermain.
Sir?
Well, let me see. 12? Sir? Or maybe 13 would be better.
Yes, sir. Teeter up, teeter down.
Douglas, said Quatermain at last, I'd like you to tell me what's life all about.
My gosh, cried Douglas. I was going to ask you that very question. Quatermain pulled back.
Let's rock a while.
There was no motion up, no motion down. They held still.
It's been a long summer, the old man said.
Seemed like it would never end, Doug agreed.
I don't think it has. Not yet, said Quatermain.
He reached out to the table beside him and found some lemonade, and poured a glass and handed it over. Douglas held the glass and took a small sip. Quatermain cleared his throat and looked at his hands.
Appomattox.
Douglas blinked.
Sir?
Quatermain looked around at the railings, the boxes of geraniums, and the wicker rockers that he and the boy sat still in.
Appomattox. You ever heard of that?
In school once.
The thing is, which one is me, which one is you?
Which one what, sir?
Lee and Grant, Doug. Grant and Lee. What color uniform are you wearing?
Douglas looked down at his sleeves and his pants and his shoes.
I see you have no better answer than I do,
observed Quatermain.
No, sir.
It was a long time ago. Two tired old generals. Appomattox.
Yes, sir.
Now,
Cal Quatermain leaned forward so his wicker bones creaked.
What is it you want to know?
Everything, said Douglas.
Everything? Quatermain laughed gently. That'll take at least 10 minutes.
How about something?
Something? One special thing? Why, Doug, that will take a lifetime. I've been at it a while. Everything rolls off my tongue easy as pie, but something, something. I get lockjaw just trying to define it. So let's talk about everything instead, for now. When you finally unhinge your tongue and find one special, eternal, forever thing of substance, let me know. Promise?
Promise.
Now, where were we? Life? There's an everything topic. You want to know all about life?
Douglas nodded, head ducked.
Steel yourself.
Douglas looked up and fixed Quartermain with a stare like the sky and all of time waiting.
Well, to begin.
He paused and held out his hand for Douglas's empty glass.
You're going to need this, son.
Quartermain poured. Douglas took and drank.
Life,
said the old man, and murmured, muttered, and murmured again. Chapter 37 Calvin C. Quartermain woke because someone had said something or called out in the night air. But that was impossible. Nobody or nothing had. He looked out the window at the great face of the courthouse clock and could almost hear it clearing its throat, preparing to announce 3 in the morning.
Who's there?
Quartermain said into the cool night air.
Me.
How's that again?
Quartermain lifted his head and peered left and right.
Me, remember?
And now he looked down along the quilt. Without moving his hands to touch and find, he knew his old friend was there. A bare subsistence of friend, but still, friend. He did not lift his head to peer down along the sheets to the small mound there below his navel, between his legs. It was hardly more than a heartbeat, a pulse, a lost member, a ghost of flesh. But it was there.
So you're back,
he said to the ceiling and snorted a chopped-off laugh.
It's been a long while.
In reply, a soft pulse of recognition.
How long will you stay?
The slender mound beat its own private heart twice, 3 times. But showed no signs of going anywhere. It seemed it would stay a while.
Is this your very last visit?
Asked Quartermain.
Who can say?
Was the silent reply of his old friend revisiting, nested in a wirework of ancient hair.
I do not so much mind my scalp turning gray, Quartermain had once said, but when you find whiteness sprouting down there, to hell with it. Let the rest of me age, but not that.
But age he did, and age it did. He was all of a dead winter grayness now. Still, there was this heartbeat, this tender and incredible pulse saluting him, a promise of spring, a seedbed of memory, a touch of... What was the word out there in the town in this strange weather when everyone's juices roused again?
Farewell, summer.
Dear God, yes. Don't go yet. Stay. I need a friend.
His friend stayed, and they talked, at 3 in the morning.
Why do I feel so happy? Said Quartermain. What's been going on? Was I mad? Am I cured? Is this the cure?
Quartermain's teeth chattered with an outrageous laugh.
I just came to say goodbye, the voice whispered.
Goodbye?
Quartermain's laughter caught in his throat.
Does that mean...
It does, came the whisper. It's been a lot of years. It's time to move on.
Time, yes,
said Quartermain, his eyes watering.
Where are you going?
Can't say. You'll know when the time comes.
How will I know?
You'll see me. I'll be there.
How will I know it's you?
You'll know. You've always known everything, but me above all.
You're not leaving town?
No, no. I'll be around. But when you see me, don't embarrass anyone, all right?
Of course.
The quilt and the sheets under the quilt were lowering, melting to rest. The whisper grew fainter.
Wherever you go,
began Quatermain.
Yes?
I wish you a long life, a good life, a happy one.
Thank you.
A pause. Silence. Quatermain found he didn't know what to say next.
Goodbye, then.
The old man nodded, his eyes misted with tears. His bed, the coverlet, his body was flat as a tabletop. What had been there for 70 years was now totally and completely gone.
Goodbye,
said Mr. Quatermain into the still night air.
I wonder, he thought, where, oh, just where in hell he has gone.
The great courthouse clock struck 3, and Mr. Quatermain slept. Douglas opened his eyes in the dark. The town clock finished the last stroke of 3. He looked at the ceiling. Nothing. He looked at the windows. Nothing. Only the night breeze fluttered the pale curtains.
Who's there?
He whispered. Nothing.
Someone's here,
he whispered. And at last he asked again.
Who,
he said,
is there?
Here,
something murmured.
What?
Me,
something spoke in the night.
Who's me?
Here,
was the quiet answer.
Where?
Here,
quietly.
Where?
And Douglas looked all around, and then down.
There?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Down along his body, below his chest, below his navel, between his 2 hip bones, where his legs joined. There it was.
Who are you?
He whispered.
You'll find out.
Where did you come from?
1 billion years past. 1 billion years yet to come.
That's no answer.
It's the only one.
Were you?
What?
Were you down in that tent today?
What?
Inside. In those glass jars. Were you?
In a way, yes.
What do you mean, in a way?
Yes.
I don't understand.
You will, when we get to know each other.
What's your name?
Give me one. We always have names. Every boy names us. Every man says that name 10,000 times in his life.
I don't
understand. Just lie there. You have 2 hearts now. Feel the pulse. One in your chest and 1 below. Yes?
Yes.
Do you actually feel the 2 hearts?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Go to sleep, then.
Will you be here when I wake up?
Waiting for you. Awake long before you. Good night, friend.
Are we friends?
The best you ever had. For life.
There was a soft rabbit running. Something hit the bed. Something burrowed beneath the blankets.
Tom? Yeah,
said the voice from under the covers.
Can I sleep here tonight? Please?
Why, Tom?
I don't know. I just had this awful feeling tomorrow morning we'd find you gone or dead or both.
I'm not going to die, Tom.
Someday you will.
Well,
can I stay?
Okay.
Hold my hand, Doug. Hold on tight.
Why?
You ever think the Earth's spinning at 25,000 miles per hour or something? It could throw you right off if you shut your eyes and forget to hold on.
Give me your hand.
There, is that better? Yeah. I can sleep now. You had me scared there for a while.
A moment of silence, breath going in and out. Tom?
Yeah?
You see, I didn't ditch you after all.
Thank gosh, Doug. Oh, thank gosh.
A wind came up outside and shook all the trees, and every leaf, every last one, fell off and blew across the lawn.
Summer's over, Tom.
Tom listened.
Summer's done. Here comes autumn. Halloween. Boy, think of that.
I'm thinking.
They thought. They slept. The town clock struck 4. And Grandma sat up in the dark and named the season just now over and done and past. Afterward. The importance of being startled. The way I write my novels can best be described as imagining that I'm going into the kitchen to fry a couple of eggs and then find myself cooking up a banquet. Starting with very simple things, they then word associate themselves with further things, until I'm up and running and eager to find out the next surprise, the next hour, the next day, or the next week. Farewell Summer began roughly 55 years ago, when I was very young and had no knowledge of novels, and no hope of creating a novel that was sensible. I had to wait for years for material to accumulate and take me unaware, so that as I sat at my typewriter, quite suddenly there would be bursts of surprise, resulting in short stories or longer narratives that I then connected together. The main action of the novel takes place in a ravine that cut across my life. I lived on a short street in Waukegan, Illinois, and the ravine was immediately east of my home and ran on for several miles in two directions, and then circled around to the north and to the south, and finally to the west. So, in effect, I lived on an island where I could at any time plunge into the ravine and have adventures. There I imagined myself in Africa or on the planet Mars. That being so, and my going through the ravine every day on my way to school and skating and sledding there in winter, this ravine remained central to my life, and so it was natural that it would become the center of this novel, with all of my friends on both sides of the ravine and the old people who were curious timepieces in my life. I've always been fascinated by elderly people. They came and went in my life, and I followed them and questioned them and learned from them. And that is primarily true in this novel, because it is a novel about children and old people who are peculiar time machines. Many of the greatest friendships in my lifetime have been with men or women who were in their 80s or 90s, and I welcomed the chance to ask them questions and then to sit very quietly, saying nothing and learning from their responses. In a way, Farewell Summer is a novel about learning by encountering old people and daring to ask them certain questions and then sitting back and listening to their answers. The questions posed by Doug and the answers given by Mr. Quartermain provide the organization of the action of the chapters and the final resolution of the book. The bottom line here is that I am not the one in control. I do not try to steer my characters. I let them live their lives and speak their truths as quickly as possible. I listen and write them down. Farewell Summer is actually an extension of my book Dandelion Wine, which I completed 55 years ago. When I delivered it to my publishers, they said, "My God, this is much too long. Why don't we publish the first 90,000 words as a novel and keep the second part for some future year when you feel it is ready to be published?" At the time, I called the full primitive version The Blue Remembered Hills. The original title for what would become Dandelion Wine was Summer Morning, Summer Night. Even all those years ago, I had a title ready for this unborn book, Farewell Summer. So it has taken all these years for the second part of Dandelion Wine to evolve to a point where I felt it was correct to send it out into the world. During the ensuing years, I waited for those parts of the novel to attract further ideas and further metaphors to add richness to the text. Surprise is everything with me. When I go to bed at night, I give myself instructions to startle myself when I wake in the morning. That was one of the great adventures in letting this novel evolve. My instructions at night
and my being startled in the morning by revelations. The influence of my grandparents and my aunt, Neva Bradbury, is in evidence all through the narrative. My grandfather was a very wise and patient man who knew the importance of showing, not simply telling. My grandmother was a wonderful woman who had an innate understanding of what made boys tick. And my Aunt Neva was the guardian and gardener of the metaphors that became me. She saw to it that I was fed all the best fairy tales, poetry, cinema, and theater, so that I was continually in a fever about life and eager to write it all down. Today, all these years later, I still feel in the writing process that she is looking over my shoulder and beaming with pride. Beyond that, there is very little to add, except that I'm glad that the long haul of writing this novel is finished, and I hope that there is pleasure in it for everyone. It has been a great pleasure for me to revisit my beloved Green Town, to gaze up at the haunted house, to hear the deep gongs of the courthouse clock, to run through the ravine, to be kissed by a girl for the first time, and to listen to and learn from the wisdom of those who have gone before.
That was Farewell Summer by Ray Bradbury,